thing we have to fear is...
In war, there is no substitute for victory.
Let us never negotiate out of fear.
We stand undivided, forever united, fighting hand in hand for the liberty we burn, for glory and honor, for our sons and daughters, ever mindful of the lessons we've learned. Let the torch of freedom burn.
Welcome to the intersection of faith and politics. This is Wall Builders Live with David Barton and Rick Green. Thanks so much for joining us today. Visit us online at wallbuilders.com and wallbuilderslive.com. You're joining us in the first part of a four-part series on a new program that David Barton just released this year. It's called Biblical Principles and the Political Process. Now, I know some people say that those two don't mix, but I have trouble finding anything in this world that doesn't mix with the Bible. Anything that the Bible does not address. And certainly politics is one of those things. In fact, there's a lot that the Bible has to say about politics. So David has done a great job of taking that information and giving it to us in a very, very entertaining video presentation. It's called Biblical Principles and the Political Process. And we're bringing it to you right here live on Wall Builders Live. So it's going to be a four-part series. We'll get the first part today. And then if for some reason you're going to be away from your radio or computer and you can't listen over the next few days, be sure and tune back in online at wallbuilderslive.com, and we'll have the entire four-part series available to you right there on the website in the archives section. Let's get started. Here's David Barton with Biblical Principles and the Political Process.
What we're going to do is look at a changing dynamic that's happening in America that's involving Christians and people of faith, biblical folks, and a need to be politically involved. And to do that, one of the things that has started changing is a lot of cities have started passing NDOs, non-discrimination ordinances. They've gone across the nation, but San Antonio did one, and it had some interesting dynamics with San Antonio. Let me show you some of the legal analysis of what happened in San Antonio and explain what's going here. As you look at San Antonio, they came up with a position that says, okay, if you publicly disagree with homosexuality or homosexual marriage, and San Antonio's in Texas, Texas had a vote on a marriage amendment. 70% of Texas said, we think marriage between a man and a woman. They said, no. If you disagree with that, if you think marriage, traditional marriage is right, if you disagree with homosexual marriage, then in the city we have a position that we're going to take against you. So if you publicly criticize or come out against homosexual marriage or homosexuality, there were several things that came out in the ordinance. Number one, you could be dismissed from office, from malfeasance in office. So if you're elected to office in San Antonio, you criticize homosexuality, homosexual marriage, bye, didn't matter what the voter said, you're out of office. It also became a Class C misdemeanor. So it is a crime, literally. It's not just we disagree with your free speech, we will criminalize it, make it a crime. On top of that, there's a $500 a day fine. So if you are a Christian person and you have a business that wants to run the Christian values, and someone comes to you and says, I want you to cater or do a cake or photography at my homosexual wedding, and first off, Texas does not allow that, but San Antonio says, if you say no to that, then we will fine you $500 a day at your business for trying to express your Christian convictions. And this is the position that really the world has held for 5,500 years until the last generation or so. So being where we've traditionally been with faith and with values is now penalized $500 a day. In addition to that, you're prohibited from running from office. So if it's found out that you've criticized homosexuality, homosexual marriage, you cannot run for office in San Antonio. We have just excluded you from office. And then on top of that, you're prohibited from doing business with the city or even being appointed to an office in the city. If you're a business and want to do business, do construction, no. If you don't have the city's position on homosexuality, homosexual marriage. And so a lot of Christians said, whoa, this is not a good deal. And that's where churches in San Antonio started standing up and saying, we've got to stop this. I mean, this is directly targeting us for what we believe. It's for our faith. It's for what we've held for a number of generations and years and centuries and millennia. And this is not right. So San Antonio has really started a movement, and it's something that's going across the nation as well. There's a movement called the National Black Robe Regiment, which is a return to the ministers of the American Revolution. The British called them the Black Robe Regiment because of the black robes they wore, but they were standing up against what was considered tyranny or wrong. They stood for righteousness. And so that's starting to happen again. Now, one of the things that happens, if you think about what happened in San Antonio, you say, wait a minute, you're going to criminalize my speech. You're going to criminalize my conscience. You're going to criminalize my choice of faith. You can't do that. The Constitution, it gives us all these rights in the Constitution. You can't come after my faith or my conscience or my speech. You know, theoretically, our rights are constitutionally given. They're all there. But the problem is they have to be politically protected. If you have people in office who don't agree with the Constitution or the values, they're not going to follow the Constitution or the law or anything else. They'll make their own laws that directly violate the Constitution. So politics becomes involved at this point. If you don't have the right kind of people in office with the right kind of values, it doesn't matter what your laws say or what your constitution. Well, you know, I have a biblical right to express my faith. Yeah, you do. You have biblical rights, but again, they are politically protected. So our rights come from the Bible, but they are politically protected. Great example, Phoenix, Arizona, pastor there having a Bible study in his home. It turns out in Phoenix they have a city ordinance that prohibits Bible studies in your home. So he got 90 days in jail for having a Bible study in his home. In America, you can't do that. Why, God gave me the right to preach the gospel. Yeah, but the city of Phoenix does not recognize your right to preach the gospel. You got a right to preach the gospel anywhere you want to. So go to Saudi Arabia, climb up in a street corner, preach the gospel, see what happens there. It's not going to be a good outcome because you don't have political protection there. So we have biblically given rights, we have constitutionally given rights, and for generations we've enjoyed them, never thought about losing them. Now that we're starting to lose them, we recognize, you know what, they're politically protected.
This is David Barton with another moment from America's history. At the time of the American Revolution, numerous other nations also had revolutions, yet 200 years later, America is the only of those nations still under its original form of government. Is this just good luck? Not according to Founding Father Benjamin Rush. He declared, "I do not believe that the Constitution was the offspring of inspiration, but I am as perfectly satisfied that it is as much the work of a divine providence as any of the miracles recorded in the Old and New Testament." George Washington agreed. In fact, he declared, "I should be pained to believe that the United States have forgotten that divine interposition which was so often manifested during our revolution, or that they fail to consider the omnipotence of that God who is alone able to protect them." Our founders acknowledged that our national success had come from God.
For more information on God's hand in American history, contact Wall Builders at 1-800-8-REBUILD.
If we do not get politically active in some of these areas, we will be penalized for what we believe, what we say, what we think, what we do. And what we're doing is what's been done for 5,500 years, quite frankly, within a biblical worldview. So that's why this is becoming a dynamic of interest. Now, in saying that and in talking about politics and using things like the non-discrimination ordinances going across the nation as a launching point, let's talk about how Christians need to approach politics. We've had a lot of Christians involved in office over the years. Frederick Douglass is a great example. He's a civil rights leader. And Frederick Douglass, as a civil rights leader, what we don't get taught in textbooks today is he's also a minister of the gospel. He was an AME Zion minister. So here you have a Christian minister, very involved in politics. He served in four different presidential administrations, and across his decades of political activity, he had one standard that he used for all of his politics. All the different presidents, all the different administrations, one standard from which he never moved, and this is the right starting place for Christians. Look what Frederick Douglass said. He said, "I have one great political idea." He said, "That idea is an old one. It's widely and generally assented to. Nevertheless, it's generally trampled on and disregarded." Everybody theoretically says, "Yeah, I agree with that," but when it comes to practice, they really don't do it in practice. Well, what is that great political idea? He says, "The best expression of it I have found in the Bible. It is in substance, righteousness exalts a nation, sins are reproach to any people." He said, "This is the baseline of my politics. This is what I judge what I'm for, what I'm against," and that's what he said. He says, "This constitutes my politics, the negative and the positive. What I'm for, what I'm against is based on that Bible verse." He said, "The whole of my politics. I feel it my duty to do all in my power to infuse this in the public mind." Now, his standard that he repeated was nothing more than Proverbs 14:34. "Righteousness exalts a nation, sins a reproach to any people." But when you look at that, if righteousness exalts a nation, how does God measure righteousness in a nation? Quite frankly, what is the standard for righteousness in a nation? Or for that matter, as you look across the Bible, you have Exodus 18:21, where it talks about not only national, but you also have things at the state level. What's the standard for righteousness at the state level? What's the standard for righteousness at what we would call the county level or the local level? You look at those leaders of tens, fifties, hundreds, thousands in the Bible, all those. How does God measure righteousness in any of those areas? And the answer is by the public policies they have and by how well those policies conform to God's standards. That public policy, is it something that God can bless or is it something he's going to have to oppose? And that's what exalts a nation. And because God bases righteousness on public policies you have, public policies affect every single person in an area, even if they disagree with that policy. I'm probably 90% of the city of San Antonio disagrees with that non-discrimination ordinance, but that city has taken a position God cannot bless. That's going to affect 100% of the people in the city, even if 90% disagree with the policy. Now, why would that be the case? I think the answer was very well explained at the Constitutional Convention when the founders were framing the Constitution of the United States. At that convention, one of the debates they had was what to do with slavery. The overwhelming majority of the delegates did not want slavery. Three southern states especially said, we will leave the Union if we don't have slavery. So you have this fight going back and forth. And one of the guys who spoke up, and it was an interesting man, his name is George Mason. George Mason is from Virginia. He is a slave owner in Virginia, and he is speaking against slavery. He said, if we do not get rid of slavery, God cannot bless the nation. There's no way. Now, why would a slave owner say that? Because in Virginia, it was illegal for him to release his slaves. He was stuck with a state law he didn't like, and now it's going into a national policy where they're not going to end slavery. And he speaks out against it, and he reminded the other delegates of something very cogent. This is what he told them. He says, as nations cannot be rewarded or punished in the next world, so they must be in this. And that's an interesting thought, because we understand as individuals, we will one day stand before God and answer for everything we do. And that'll happen in the future. There may be some judgments that go now with based on decisions we make, but we will stand before God in the future, but not nations. God is not going to resurrect the Soviet Union in the future and say, why did you, Soviet Union's gone. It's over. It's done with. It's not there anymore. That's what he points out. There is, nations have to be rewarded or punished in this world, not in the next. He says, by an inevitable chain of causes and effects, Providence punishes national sins by national calamities. He said, if we do not get rid of slavery, God will punish the nation for slavery, and he'll do it through some type of national calamity. I think we called it a civil war in which 600,000-700,000 individuals died. People like Abraham Lincoln said, this is the judgment for us not having dealt with slavery. James Madison, when in 1820, when they did the Missouri Compromise, said, this is going to produce a civil war because we have not dealt with the slavery issue. So God judges nations, states, cities, local areas based on the public policies they have, and he takes a position right then. Another person who made this very clear is this man, Reverend Chandler Robbins. He was actually addressing the legislature of Massachusetts. And it used to be a tradition in America for about 170 years that you started your state legislative sessions by having a joint session of the legislature, the governor, lieutenant governor, the House, Senate all came in, and you brought a minister in to start the legislative session with a sermon. And as he is speaking to the entire elected bodies in Massachusetts, he's reminding them of the same principle. He said, guys, the policies you take will have an effect on every single citizen in the state. He explained this way. He said, the supreme governor of the world rewards or punishes nations and civil communities only in this life. He said, political bodies are but the creatures of time. They exist only right now. God rewards or punishes them right now. He says, they have no existence as such, but in the present state, consequently, they're incapable of punishments or rewards in the future. He says, we can conceive of no way in which the divine being shall therefore manifest the purity of his nature towards such societies, but by rewarding or punishing them here according to their public conduct. That's one reason that biblical people, Christians, people of faith, have to be involved in public policy decisions.
This is David Barton with another moment from America's history. Since the Ten Commandments have formed the basis of civil law in the Western world for over 2,000 years, an individual is more likely to find a copy of them in a government building rather than a religious one. Yet amazingly, numerous rulings over recent years now make it unconstitutional to display the commandments in many public arenas. Consider what Founding Father John Adams said about this. He declared, "The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, anarchy and tyranny commence. If thou shalt not covet and thou shalt not steal were not commandments of heaven, they must be made inviolable precepts in every society before it can be civilized or made free." John Adams believed that no society could remain civilized if separated from the Ten Commandments.
For more information on God's hand in American history, contact Wall Builders at 1-800-8-REBUILD.
Let the torch of freedom burn.
Those public policy decisions do result in consequences. A great example of that is what you see in the Bible with the story of Elijah. Remember Elijah? The leaders then were Ahab and Jezebel. They were very wicked leaders. They did a lot of bad policy. They were into eminent domain. You remember they took Naboth's vineyard, said the government wants this private property. The prophet Elijah confronts them, says, because of the wickedness of your administration, what you've done in public policy, we've gone 3.5 years without rain in this nation. Now, I want you to remember that God had already confronted Elijah and said, you know, there's 7,000 folks in this nation that never bowed their knee to Baal. I got 7,000 righteous folks. That's right. They were righteous, but they all went 3.5 years without rain. Even the good guys had to go through the national judgment brought on by bad policies from national leaders. And so even if you disagree with those policies, even if you disagree with non-discrimination ordinances, if your city has one, God's not going to be able to bless that. There's no way he takes a position on it. So even for those who don't get involved in politics, you will pay a price for what your political leaders do. You're not isolated from that because there is no future for a political body. They're rewarded, punished right there at that point in time. Now, from that background, righteousness exalts a nation. How do you end up getting righteous policies in a city, a state, a nation, a county? How do you get those righteous policies? And the answer is given strictly out of the Bible. We get righteous policies enacted by Proverbs 29:2 that says, when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. If you get the right philosophy of people in office, they will do things that God can bless. If you get the wrong philosophy of people in office, they will do things that God will oppose, and that affects every single individual under their jurisdiction. So the best way to have righteous policies is to have God-fearing leaders. You get God-fearing leaders, they understand they're accountable to God, they won't pass those kind of policies. That goes back to why politics is important. Politics is merely the process of putting leaders in office. If you put the right kind of leaders in office, you don't have to worry about the downstream effects of bad policies. Now, having said that, and looking at how to go at this, and looking even historically at what we do with this, let me take you back to the founding of America. Because the founding of America is the first time that we start, as Americans, creating our very own governments. We've never had to do this before. It came about as a result of the American Revolution. Because of what happened in the American Revolution, specifically when they signed the Declaration of Independence, well, they've separated from Great Britain, but they've done something else. All 13 of those colonies had British-run governments. And by separating from Great Britain, they have wiped out 13 state governments. So these guys that signed the Declaration of Independence have just abolished 13 state governments. They firmly believe, out of Romans 13, out of 1 Peter, out of 1 Timothy, that God ordained civil government. You're not to be without civil government. That's anarchy. But they've just wiped out governments. So what do? The same guys who wiped out the state governments then turn around and go home to their states and start creating the very first governments in American history. For example, you take folks out of New Jersey, like the Reverend Dr. John Witherspoon. He heads home to help write the brand new Constitution for New Jersey. You also take folks like out of Maryland. You have Charles Carroll of Carrollton, Maryland. He heads home to write the new Constitution for Maryland. These guys have just wiped out state governments. They're not to be without government, so they go create their own. And as you look at what they did in creating these early state governments, there's so many of these founders that had an impact in their state constitutions. Let me take you, for example, to Delaware. Delaware writes their new constitution in 1776. And the guys that were key in writing that constitution, you see there in that picture of those who did the declaration. You see, for example, folks like Thomas McKean. You also have George Read. You also have John Dickinson. Well, these three guys from Delaware, they go home, write the brand new constitution for Delaware. If you read the 1776 Constitution of Delaware, done by our founding fathers, interesting provision in that Constitution. Constitution of Delaware says this, "Every person who shall be chosen a member of either house must say, I do profess faith in God the Father, and in the Lord Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God and blessed forevermore, and I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures, the Old and New Testament, be given by divine inspiration. Well, what a requirement to hold public office. And we would love that if that was a requirement for seminary today. That was a requirement for public office in Delaware under the Founding Fathers. Now, why would they do that? What kind of policies do you think you'll get from those kind of people? People who understand this about the Scriptures, that there's accountability, they're going to make sure that they don't do things that tick God off, and therefore the whole nation gets blessed, the whole state gets blessed. That's what they understood. You have that with other constitutions as well. If you take, for example, the Constitution of Massachusetts, a number of the Founding Fathers who signed the Declaration went home to write the Constitution of Massachusetts, including Robert Treat Paine. You have Samuel Adams. You also have John Adams. You have John Hancock. Great Founding Fathers we all recognize wrote the Constitution of Massachusetts. 1780 is their original Constitution, by the way. It is still in play today. It's the only Constitution in the world older than the United States Constitution. Massachusetts still uses the first and only Constitution they've ever had, 1780. And this is what it requires in that Constitution written by the Founding Fathers. Any person chosen governor or lieutenant governor, counselor, senator, or representative must say, I do declare that I believe the Christian religion have firm persuasion of its truth. That's still a requirement in Massachusetts today. Yeah, but they don't follow their Constitution anymore, just like a lot of people don't follow the U.S. Constitution anymore. We don't know it. We don't have people in office who think it's important, so we ignore things like that. And this is not to say that, hey, we discriminate against everyone who is not a Christian. That's not the point of this. And this is not what Article 6 in the Constitution prohibits when it says there can be no federal test, no religious test. It's the federal government that can't say, hey, you've all got to be Baptist or Methodist. They didn't want a national denomination like we had in Great Britain. They're not excluding God. They're not excluding in fear of God. Matter of fact, the Declaration starts, its first premise is we, and it says, we in unanimous 13 states in Congress assembled, we say there is a creator. That's a government declaration. We believe in God. We believe there's a creator. We've always believed that until people who didn't like God started telling us we couldn't say that publicly. And again, that's because we had the wrong people in office who don't like that position. But again, this is the notion that if you have God-fearing people in office, you'll get God-fearing policies in office. It doesn't have to be Christians. There's a lot of, quite frankly, there's a lot of God-fearing Jews I'd rather see in office than a lot of Christians I know in office because they understand biblical principles better. So you get God-fearing people in office, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to do the Proverbs 29:2 thing that when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. You go to other states. Let's take on to the state of Pennsylvania. Now, Pennsylvania, the signer of the Declaration from Pennsylvania who helped write their Constitution is Ben Franklin. So Ben Franklin goes home in 1776 to write the Constitution of Pennsylvania. Ben Franklin's our least religious founding father. Look what Franklin puts in the Constitution of Pennsylvania, 1776. It says, and each member of the legislature must say, I do believe in God, in one God, the creator and governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good, the punisher of the wicked, and I acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. That's Ben Franklin, least religious founding father. But notice, he doesn't want you in office unless you believe there are future rewards and punishments.
Have you ever wanted to learn more about the United States Constitution but just felt like, man, the classes are boring, or it's just that old language from 200 years ago, or I don't know where to start? People want to know, but it gets frustrating because you don't know where to look for truth about the Constitution either. Well, we've got a special program for you available now called Constitution Alive with David Barton and Rick Green, and it's actually a teaching done on the Constitution at Independence Hall in the very room where the Constitution was framed. We take you both to Philadelphia, the cradle of liberty and Independence Hall, and to the Wall Builders Library, where David Barton brings the history to life to teach the original intent of our founding fathers. We call it the Quick Start Guide to the Constitution because in just a few hours through these videos, you will learn the Citizen's Guide to America's Constitution. You'll learn what you need to do to help save our constitutional republic. It's fun, it's entertaining, and it's going to inspire you to do your part to preserve freedom for future generations. It's called Constitution Alive with David Barton and Rick Green. You can find out more information on our website now at wallbuilders.com.
Let the torch of freedom burn.
If you know that you're going to answer to God for what you do in office, there's a lot of stuff you won't do in office. And if you won't do that in office, the whole state's going to be better off. We'll have better policies. We'll have better. We're not going to have the corruption. See, that's what you get out of that kind of state after state. I mean, go to North Carolina. You see the same kind of results in North Carolina. North Carolina, 1776, says, no person who shall deny the being of God or the truth of the Christian religion or the divine authority of either the Old or New Testaments shall be capable of holding any office or place of trust or profit in the civil department within the state. All of this was designed to point toward Proverbs 29:2, which says, when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. You will find the founding fathers put an emphasis on putting the right kind of people in office. Now, with that emphasis, there is an aspect of American history that becomes interesting that led up to the founding fathers, where you had a debate over what are the right approaches philosophically to government. And there were two sides taken. One side was taken by folks like John Locke. Now, John Locke is a political philosopher. He's considered a theologian. He wrote Commonplace, Commentary on the Scriptures. He wrote several defenses of Christianity. But he's the guy who helped write the original Constitution for Carolina back in 1690. And Carolina was originally one colony. It was not North and South when he wrote the Constitution for them. So his philosophy is very simple. He says, we've got to keep this thing where we can have righteous government. The best way to do that is to make sure that we load up the Constitution with all these good, God-fearing laws, and then no matter who gets in office, if they get in office 200 years from now, they're going to be bound by all these God-fearing laws in the colony's constitution. So he created the 1690 Constitution of Carolina with that philosophy, that if we get good laws in there, then no matter who gets in office, we'll have good government. That was one approach.
We're out of time for today, folks. That was part one in a four-part series on biblical principles and the political process. Tune in tomorrow. We'll pick up right where we left off today. You've been listening to Wall Builders Live.